Good afternoon, and welcome to Who's in the Kitchen. You're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM coming from Viroqua, Wisconsin. We're a community radio station in the Driftless area, southwestern Wisconsin. And Who's in the Kitchen is a cooking show and food show, and today I'm going to be talking with Tim Kniep about bees. He's one of a number of bee raisers in our community, and he loves to talk about bees. So welcome, Tim. We'll spend an hour talking about bees.
Good morning, Philothea.
So happy to have you on the show. I know we're going to get into what bees do, but I really want people to know that bees are a really important part of our food system, and we might just think, well, they're just a little insect, and maybe people only think that bees sting or something like that, but we really need to know bees are really important. So, but anyway, I'm going to ask...
It's about a third of our food system or more depends on them.
Okay, so you can explain what part that plays, but... Well, we could just start with why you got interested in bees and why you raise bees.
Well, I love nature. I studied natural resource management in school.
Mm-hmm.
My other works involved in agriculture and nature, and I found bees to always be interesting. I've always loved honey. So that started with a kid. We used to buy it by the 5-gallon bucketfuls as a kid. And I took a little short class that's offered through the library system here, the Viroqua Public Library, every year.
In fact, I think I saw a notice for that the other day.
Yeah, I think it's over, but Jim Krause, a local beekeeper for several decades, teaches that. I took that, and I've been a gardener. I've always been interested in native stuff and plants, and... that interest in science, and I kind of have a thing for learning. I love to continuously learn new, and bees give me that. They give me honey. They give me outdoor work. They give me a continuous learning curve. There's always more to learn, whether it's from a book, and this is just a few I brought with me, online, through observation. And last year, what sealed it for me to continue growing as a business with my bees was having my 6-year-old daughter out there in her little bee suit working the bees with me. She loved it. I loved it. And I love sharing that with people. So that's kind of my drive.
Okay.
You know, I'm an old... business guy as well, so I love the sell and doing that work as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned just before the show, they're wild bees, and then they're like domesticated bees or bees that you keep, and do they cross over? You hear about people going out and getting a hive of wild bees out of a tree or something like that, or out of somebody's house. What's the connection between wild bees and domestic bees?
Well, let's start here. I was listening to a podcast from the University of Washington State, and they were talking about native pollinators. And I believe, if I remember correctly, their guest said that there was like 600 species of bees in the state of Washington. Wild bees, native bees. There are thousands of them across America. The one bee that people think of the most that is not a native bee is the honeybee, Apis mellifera. It comes from Europe. It's native there.
Oh, I see.
It is not a native bee. So in some ways, in some people's mind, that creates a conflict between the two because they do use many of the same resources, not all of them, because there is a difference. But they can cross over. You want me to go into more detail on that?
I do. I want to know what bees actually do. I'm sort of thinking about what is their cycle? What do they do?
Well, it depends on the bees. there's like mason bees, there's carpenter bees, there's all kinds. And they come out and are active, the native bees, at different points. Like the mason bees are very early bees. They're mostly small, except for like the bumblebees, which are different. But most of the native bees nest either in the ground, in dead vegetation, stems. So you drive by my house, I kind of, my place, my tiny little farm stands out, neighborhood, because I don't take anything down in my garden. I don't mow down my prairie strips. I leave all the dead standing until well into summertime, because those native pollinators, not just bees, but other things as well, will use those stems and that ground undisturbed.
Oh.
That's where they nest. They are not, we think of bears finding honeybees in trees and stuff like that. That's, I'm not trying to sell myself as a native bee expert, but I don't believe we have too many native bees that would do that. They're mostly ground lower dwellers.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
And they are like butterflies and stuff. They are magnificent pollinators. They use the pollen. So what's the difference between them and honeybees? Well, most of them are solitary. They don't form colonies.
Oh.
They're individual. Some of the wild bees will find holes or stems, and there's variations on how this happens, but they will then, after they come out, emerge, they'll feed, they'll go back, find this cavity, lay an egg, put a little pollen patty, seal it up, lay another one. And they're laying little eggs. They're not building comb.
Oh.
So honeybees come from Europe, and they do like trees. They are a forest bee. In fact, if I remember correctly, Eastern Europe and towards Russia, they used, one of the great professions to have was to be a beekeeper. And they did it in the king's forest, and they actually cut cavities in trees with opening doors, and they would climb the trees and get the honey from the bees, and they'd manage them that way in a much more. Now, here in America and most of the rest of the world that raises bees, I've seen them in China, they use hives. And what we're basically doing is trying to replicate that environment of that hollow in a tree,
mm-hmm,
in a form that's convenient for us. Because our goal is with honeybees is to get honey and other products. The Langstroth hive, which is the square hive, you see there's hundreds of variations of different hives. You can go really old school with what they call skep, which is the like upside down basket, basically. Now there's horizontal hives, there's barrel hives,
vertical hives.
There's all kinds of hives. The Langstroth was actually developed in America by a preacher, and he wanted to be able to get his honey out easier without having to destroy. With like a skep, they would pick it up and break off the bottom of the combs, and they take care of everything. So there's a lot of ways to do it, but our goal with the European honeybee, they come from a lot of places. There's strains from Europe, Italy, a common one you hear, or they call them Italians or Carolinians. There's a Russian strains that have slightly different characteristics, but they're all very similar.
Mm-hmm.
So with the honeybees, we're after the honey. One of the things I like to talk about is the competition. Do they use the same resources? They do. There is overlap there.
So what are their resources?
Basically, pollen and nectar. For almost all the pollinators, they're looking at pollen and nectar.
Now, what do they do with the pollen? I thought that was just accidental. No, they actually
use it. Even many of the wild bees do. They use it. They make little patties. Honeybees mix it and make what they call bee bread. If you pick up, especially in the fall, you can pick up a when your frames of honey, and there'll be all these little hexagonal cells, and there'll be bunches of them filled with different colored stuff. And that's pollen from different plants, so it can give it a different color. And they use that as a protein and a food over winter. And pollen, that protein that they get from that, is very important in what we call the brood cycle. So like in spring, the queen won't start laying till it's warm enough. And she has enough protein.
Mm-hmm.
So they're getting that pollen in and upping the protein, and that initiates it. That's what the wild bees leave their larvae, their eggs. They lay an egg, then they put a little patty. It's a lot of pollen in there becomes the food once that egg hatches and turns into a larvae. So the other resource that they're using is the nectar. So they visit the flowers. Honeybees visit like 1,000 flowers a day. Some, it's crazy that they go to visit. I've heard that wild bees will even visit more. And in that recent podcast I was telling you about from University of Washington, they were actually saying that the little mason bees, and these are little guys, way smaller than a honeybee, they're actually more efficient. They're very furry, and they pick the hairs on their bodies just like a honeybee, pick up the pollen, and because they visit so many flowers, that they'll visit 2,000 flowers a day. And they're incredibly efficient pollinators. Why we rely, to bring it back to food for a second, why we rely so extensively on the honeybees to pollinate our food crops, like the California food crops. If you look at a California orchard, the majority of, there are some that are starting to creep away from this. You will see next to nothing on the ground underneath thousands of acres of trees. It's bare ground.
Is that because they killed the grass? They killed the
weeds?
They
don't want anything, or they mow it down to the dirt because it makes their harvesting process easier. But in that process, what have they destroyed?
Yeah.
All the habitat. So they don't have enough pollinators because they've destroyed the habitat. Honeybees are able to fill that gap. And I'm not saying this is the way it should be, maybe in a perfect world, but they fill that gap because they have a different habitat requirement. And because we've, quote unquote, domesticated them as much as we can, they live in those hives. They spend their whole lives in and out of those hives.
So at what point are they just alive and, you know, have wings? And when do they have their eggs and, you know?
Well, the queen will start laying in the spring. And she will lay as long as her nutritional requirements are met. She will start laying, and she will lay all the way into fall.
Hmm.
She never stops.
So she lays eggs.
That's her only function. Queen basically has two functions: laying eggs and emitting pheromones that keep the hive together. Because they know their queen. She's not the boss of the hive. It's much more communistic than that. She keeps laying. She gets fed. She got taken care of. The worker bees, which are the vast majority of the bees in a hive. Now we're talking kept bees, not wild bees. They're different. They do have male and female too, but it's much more random. But in a honey hive, the queen will keep laying. She's fed. They're by bees, and there's other bees that do job. But one of the reasons she has to keep laying is because bees live 40 days, maybe, in that area, and then they die. They're done. So she has to keep a constant stream of new bees coming. Mm-hmm. And a new worker bee takes about 22 days from the time she lays that egg to the time it's ready to start its life. Hatches.
Does the worker bee have a sex?
Female. The queen's a female. So if you have a hive that has 40 to 50,000 bees, I've read the numbers somewhere, and I can't remember, something like 98% of them are female. And they're workers. The male bees are what they call drones. And she lays, if it's a healthy queen, a healthy hive, she lays very few drones. Their only job is to mate, and they eat. They don't collect nectar. They don't collect pollen. They mate and they eat. That's why in the fall, the worker bees, which are female, will kick them out of the hive, not let them back. They get rid of them. They don't need them over winter. So all the males are killed off every fall.
I didn't know this.
Honeybees are infinitely fascinating, but they're also fairly brutal in the way they operate. If a queen, as she gets older or for whatever reason, stops laying or doesn't lay enough, we call it the hive is no longer what we call queen right. That means you have a good queen, she's working, she's doing what she's supposed to do. The worker bees, which are all female, by the way, not the guys doing this. The guys are just out looking for a good time, you know, and free honey. They will make a new queen and kick her out. So there's this brutal cutthroatness of protecting the hive. It's all about protecting the hive. So they work as a colony to protect themselves, which is vastly different from what the native bees do. Now, we can come back to details about hive behavior, mm-hmm. but I want to slip in before I lose this thought. Could we pollinate our crops with our native pollinators? Maybe. I'm not an expert enough on this, but here's the problem. There's not enough habitat to get those enough native bees. They have to be there on spot. You can't transport them. Mm-hmm. I take that back a little bit. There's actually a company called Rent-A-Bee. They'll send you mason bees in these little bee houses and stuff. But that's not going to pollinate a crop or an orchard. You need millions of them. So we would have to make a concerted choice as a society that we're going to invest in enough native habitat to bring the pollinators back.
And we're really killing off the habitat
We chew it up as fast as we seem to be able to.
Because it seemed to be wasteland. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people look at this as just, let's mow it down, let's trim it, let's kill it, let's manage it, let's build a house on it, and they don't realize, like you say, you're leaving your yard kind of messy. You're leaving all the vegetation from the fall for all through the winter. And we aren't doing that anymore, are we?
Too many people don't. We have this, like the lawn, you know, lawns in Europe were signs of being wealthy. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, your yard, lawn, was a garden. It was producing food.
Mm-hmm.
Only the wealthy could afford to have a patch of grass that did nothing.
Mm.
Well, we seem to have bought into that as what we view as a standard. You know, I was out walking with my daughter, ran into a neighbor who's in HOA. They won't even let them put solar panels on it because it's not pretty. It's that mindset that pushes us away from good, positive ecological solutions.
Mm.
And it's the idea that I think it's really started to me two things in the 30s, 40s, into the 50s with agriculture. You had the agricultural revolution where you brought in petrochemicals after the war for fertilizer and stuff. And then that same kind of idea, we started getting this idea that we need to feed the world. And so we produce more and more and more and more and more and more and more. This idea that we're feeding the world, and we don't really need to. Most of the time, I used to work with a gentleman from Italy who used to go down kind of their version of Peace Corps and try to start projects in Africa. And he says, when you really think about it, most of it, excluding the issues with war, and war created famines, they could feed themselves.
I was thinking. They have, and they will, and they can. And
right. Mm-hmm. And even with their own native food systems. And then we bring in and try to get them to plant corn and soybean. It's just like we work really hard to shoot ourselves in the foot to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So this lack of and destruction of habitat is what puts our native pollinators under stress, which affects everything else.
Mm.
Butterflies, bees, all those hummingbirds, they need that native habitat. All of our songbirds, our migratory birds, they need that habitat. We mow it down. So, I mean, there's nothing prettier in the spring when the red-winged blackbirds are flying through and they land on some of my dead prairie plants and just, you know, especially the little red-shouldered males, you know, and they're just claiming the area for themselves, you know. But they can do that because the habitat's still there.
Mm-hmm. I want to just take a break. You're listening to Who's in the Kitchen on WDRT Community Radio, 91.9 FM, coming from Viroqua, Wisconsin, in the Driftless area. And, yeah, I'm talking with Tim Kniep. We're talking about bees. We've mainly just talking in general about wild bees and pollinators and domesticated bees that really come from Europe, and they aren't native to our country. And so, yeah, so I wanted to kind of go into a little bit about what the heck does pollinating have to do with fruit and other things. I mean, grains are a fruit. Grains need pollinating, right? There are a lot of flowers we don't really see. We don't really know they're flowering, but they have pollen too.
Grass has pollen.
So
some of those are also wind pollinated, things like that.
So wind can pollinate, but but what in the cycle of food, where do the bees fit in? Not with the honey, but with all the work they're doing. From flower to flower.
So, what is your favorite stone fruit?
Well,
let's ask you that.
Okay. I like cherries.
Cherries. I love cherries. I got three cherry trees. I love apples. Three of those. Love pears.
Peaches.
Any of those things. Anything, any plant that produces a flower and then a fruit of some kind. Tomatoes, even. Without a pollinator, most of those cannot. There are exceptions in the world. There are some plants that are self-pollinating. But most of those that we think of are not. They need to be pollinated. It can be from a native bee. It can. There's beetles that spread pollen. There's honeybees. There's like, with the larger flowers especially, there's hummingbirds that actually spread pollen to an extent. Because the flowers are not self-pollinating. There are plants that are self-pollinating, but most of these aren't. Like our early example, almonds. They can't pollinate themselves. So they need pollen from a different flower.
Oh, so these bees or insects are floating around. They're dropping off, stopping off, going from flower to flower.
They're not doing it purposely. The flowers bring them in by the nectar, which is one of the things. And then the insects pick up the pollen. And they move on to the next flower. And it gets dropped and picked up. And just this cycle that happens. And then the ovum in that bottom of the flower can fertilized. This is, I believe, the right way to say that. And then that's what grows into a fruit.
Oh.
So without that pollinator, it would be a beautiful, it's like, I have some beautiful trees in my yard. But say my apple tree, it would bloom in the spring. If there were no pollinators, all those blooms would come, they would go, and I'd have no apples.
Yes, now I have a cranberry, a high bush cranberry.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have a male and female bush. I apparently only have the male, I guess, or because I don't have both, it makes flowers, but there's never any berries.
Right.
So I don't know if it's a male or female. Was it the females make the flowers? And I really don't know.
Well, they may both produce flowers, but the female would produce the fruit.
Oh, yeah.
So it's just like pear trees are, apples a little different generally. Pear trees, you need two pears. Preferably of different types. Just, I have three. But, so, you can't, if, for instance, I had kefir pears, just kefir pears, I would have very little pollination happening.
If you just had one.
Right. So, but I have three different species, so they can help them.
Mm-hmm.
Some fruit trees like apricot, they don't need multiples. Apples don't need multiples. But some of those trees will still produce fruit. They can still be pollinated. But if you bring in another one for them to get pollen from, they are much more productive.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it's from the native bees or the honeybees. And you know, the honeybees, like I said, they do compete some, but the biggest thing holding native bees back is habitat.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the honeybees competing. It's how we've created our and rewarded our agricultural system.
Mm-hmm.
So that is more affecting. And the way we as individuals, even if we're not farmers, the way we manage what real land we do have greatly impacts them. For instance, if you use a lot of grub baits and poisons and stuff around your place because you don't like to see molehills or whatever, that impacts ground nesting bees, which are our native bees.
No.
Won't hurt the honeybees. But it will, anything that nests in the ground, they can get poisoned. If you spray a lot of insecticides and stuff in your yard, use a lot of Roundup, that stuff gets into it. Now we get in that category, those can start impacting honeybees. So,
and I also see people who, they have bee raisers bring their hives and put them in at their near their orchard or something.
Yes,
like that.
That's like
is that a good idea to do?
Well, it will help any orchard.
You can visit me and bring your bees. I just have a few fruit trees.
Right.
But they seem to be get pollinated. But you are kind of wanting to have your bees have a good source, right?
Yes. There's ups and downs in that game. Like, we'll never send our honeybees to California. We don't ship them around. There's just one that's buying into a system that I think's broken.
Where do you buy your bees?
Well, there are bee breeders. I feel, can you hear me? There are bee breeders. A lot of the bees you get this time of year up here in Wisconsin, because of our normal weather, excluding this year, it's too cold to breed queens. So, and most beekeepers want to get bees late April, early mid-May up here time frame. So a lot of people will either get their bees from the south, bring them up, or from California, or a lot of our local guys who do this, what they do is they focus, they're not so focused on honey production, which is more the angle I'm at. They're making their money selling bees. So what they'll do is they'll have overwinter bees here or sometimes in the south and bring them back in the spring. And then they, once those, they'll build them up really strong, then they'll split. They'll just sometimes they'll bring in queens from, like, I'm getting queens from Georgia and California this year. I'm trying some different ones, but they're going to be paired with local bees. That way the local guys can get something to sell to for people who are wanting to start new hives. I'm getting quite a few because I'm adding a bunch of new hives this year, and I had significant winter losses.
What are the bees doing in the winter?
Eating, trying to stay alive for the most part. They will stay in the hive. If it gets over 40 degrees, you will see them start to fly, and they generally make short. They're flying out of the hive to take a poop. Because bees are hygienic. They don't like to poop inside their hive. So they'll take short flights. But they'll come right back in. And they're trying to stay warm. And they're trying to protect the queen. That's their job during the winter. One of the fascinating things about bees in wintertime that is... Remember earlier I told you worker bees live about 45 days, or 40 days, 41, 42, somewhere in there. Queen can live for years, 4 or 5 years. Most of them don't make it that long for a number of reasons, because their productivity drops down too low, they get injured, something happens, right? And they get replaced. Either the beekeeper will buy a new queen, or the hive will replace her themselves. But in the late summer, early fall, she starts laying, I use the word type, a different type of bee than she normally lays, right?
Oh.
She's no longer laying any males, but these bees, we call them winter bees.
Oh, okay.
And they will live for months.
Oh, I was wondering, is, you know, 45 days, I thought, well, that's not going to get you through the winter.
They don't.
Oh.
So those bees are dying off towards the end of summer. Mm. You know, there's not much food out there anymore. And she's starting to lay a different type of bee that will hatch and carry the hive through winter.
Oh, okay.
So there's a... Really physically looking at them, I couldn't tell the difference. Maybe a bee scientist could, but I couldn't. I just know that they last longer. And that's kind of a critical period for the hive, is to make sure that the hive goes into the fall with the great killer of honeybees is the varroa mite. Aptly named Varroa destructor, because it can.
How do you spell that?
V-E-R-O-A destructor, Varroa mite, and it probably kills more hives than anything.
Does it kill the eggs or what?
What it does is the mites will move in to the hive off bees. They go into the hive. They find cells, empty cells, brood cells. They will lay an egg in there, and then the queen comes along, lays an egg, and then they attach the larvae and feed on the larvae. They don't always kill it, but they can make them much more susceptible to stressors, mm-hmm. diseases, mm-hmm. stressors, things like that. I've seen it once in my hive, and I treated for it, and it didn't. In one of my hives, there's a common virus that they seem to spread. It's called DWS, damaged wing syndrome. Mm-hmm. You'll start seeing little worker bees where their wings are kind of crinkled and stuff, and that's generally a sign of a high mite population.
Mm-hmm.
So... you don't want these winter bees, because they've got to last, because she'll stop laying at the point.
Oh, and dear.
You want them. So the late summer, early fall treatment, and maybe even another mite treatment later on before it gets too cold, is very important.
Wow. What kind of treatment is that?
There are...
Some biological...
There's natural ones. If you want to go real old school and natural, some people will take rhubarb leaves. You know, the rule, don't eat rhubarb leaves, right? Because they're poisonous. The oxalic acid in it.
Mm-hmm.
But the oxalic acid kills mites, but not bees in the right low concentrations. So the old guys will put that on there and just throw a leaf top of the inside the hive. And let it thing. The bees will eventually clean it out, but as it degrades, it'll release some oxalic acid. Mm-hmm. There are other more industrialized versions of oxalic acid. Some guys will use the big commercial guys mostly will use vaporizers, so they get a pure form of the crystal. And they blow a vaporized version of that into a hive. And it's industrialized, but it's still kind of a natural product. It's oxalic acid. It's everywhere. Another common one is formic acid. And again, you put it in different methods into the hive, mostly in kind of like little sponges that evaporate and let the acid move through the hive.
Mm, does that come from ants?
You know, I don't know the actual, but formic acid is actually naturally found in honey, very low concentrations. One of the things we make sure we do, and depending on the product you're using, you know, some of them are because they're refined now, they're controlled. You have to apply them by label. But... we use formic because in the late summer, early fall, because we're trying to hit that window where she's starting to maybe lay some winter brood. And versus oxalic will kill the mites, but if there's any sealed brood, that means the brood's capped, the egg's turned into a larvae, right? And it's starting to turn into a pulpate, and then the bees cap it. And then when it's mature, it eats its way out. Formic acid will penetrate that brood cap and get anything out. So we have to apply it less frequently. Mm-hmm. We really work hard. One, we don't, kind of going back to what I was saying about label and controls, some of these they say you can put on with honey, hot supers, honey boxes on the hive. We don't. We never apply treatment with any honey boxes. So our honey frames and our honey that we process for sale is never exposed to any of these. Doesn't need to be. That's kind of our ethos of making. I make and sell products that my family eats. And that's how what I want them to eat. So I'm not going to sell something that I've doused in chemicals to someone else. So we're really, really kind of try to be tight. We've made mistakes in that we haven't treated enough and have had issues, and we have played a little catch up, and we're learning and growing and trying. I'm looking at some other natural mite controls, one made from hop plants or hemp? I can't remember off the top of my head. That is a lower level, kind of a maintenance control, so that we don't have to hit them as hard if we can keep it back. Again, we want to make sure even though that one I'm looking at is approved to be used with honey supers, still not going to do it. It's just...
Well, I'm talking with Tim Kniep. He's a resident here in Viroqua, and you're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM, streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org, where you could be, maybe you're listening right now on the internet, or you can tune into this show again. If you didn't have notepaper and writing all this down, you might want to listen to this show again. And you just go to our website, go to Who's in the Kitchen, and... archives, and you'll find this show and many, many others. We have lots of podcasts on our archives. I'm Philothea Beeson, and thank you so much for tuning in to Who's in the Kitchen and our community radio station. We haven't even gotten to the honey. So, and this sounds like it's really complicated, but I'm looking, you've got a stack of books here, and I just want to take a little break and say, you know, you're always learning, and there's workshops, there's classes, but can you mention some of the books that you think are useful? Sure there are hundreds.
Yeah. These are two that I found over the last couple of years that I really like, and this first one's a little one. And this touches on native bees and honeybees. You know, it talks about things like squash bees. Who's ever heard of a squash bee? They're
it
a real
almost
thing.
Looks like a golden book almost of bees with little pictures.
You know, and it's called OMFG. It's written with a little tongue in cheek. So it's really fun to read. It's not obscene, despite that abbreviation, OMFG bees. And its bees are so amazing, and you're about to find out why. I've read it twice. It's just fun. I mean, because it actually fills in some knowledge.
Something to begin with.
Yes, yeah, it's just great. It's not a how to be a beekeeper book. It is not that. But it's written by Matt Crachet, K-R-A-C-H-T. I'm not sure if our local library has it. So lots of fun bee facts of both native and honeybees. Well worth the read. Easy for teenagers, even a little bit younger, older, advanced readers to tackle. I've read some with my daughter from here. There's funny stories from history. It's just a great introduction to the world of bees.
Oh, great.
And a fun way to do it.
And that's called?
It's called OMFG.
What does that stand for? I don't know.
Oh, my blank God.
Okay.
Bees. Uh-huh. So it's OMFG, bees. Mm-hmm. Bees are so amazing, and you're about to find out why.
Aww.
It's a great book. Highly recommend it for someone who just wants to kind of to grow their knowledge a little bit, stick their toe into the world of bees and pollinators. Mm-hmm. Great book.
Mm-hmm.
For those who like to chew a little deeper, without going into, I didn't bring any books on beekeeping.
Okay.
I mean, they're endless.
You're right.
I mean, beekeeping for dummies is actually not a bad place to start if you want to start thinking about it. But I brought this book, which amazes me. This is called The Lives of Bees. The Lives of Bees. The Untold Story of the Honeybee in the Wild. It's written by Thomas D. Seeley. And he's a professor. And what he's done, and he's out east, he has studied Apis mellifera, the European honeybee, in the wild of America. Because they are wild populations of honeybees.
Mm.
And he talks about so much bee biology and all these things I've talked about, you know, time and how long they live. He talks about all that. And he gets a little geeky. He's a university professor, both studies bees. But if you're wanting to bite off, I mean, you're not, I don't want to be a beekeeper, but I want to learn more.
Okay.
This is an amazing book. Okay. I just love it.
The Lives of Bees.
Lives of Bees, Untold Stories. So these are the two bee books I brought with me today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've mentioned habitat, the impact of agriculture and stuff. So I brought, because, you know, I figured we'd touch on that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I brought two books that I think are worth reading, very much so. And it's kind of the same one. One's a little lighter, a little bit more, then one gets a little deeper.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one's called Dirt to Soil.
So this is kind of getting into my farming interest because
yes.
I want to know how bees fit into the whole picture.
They're part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is written by Gabe Brown. He's out in the Dakotas. And how he took the family farm and turned it into a regenerated farm. And how they've stopped tilling and brought livestock back and all these things to rebuild the native grasses and forbs and stuff. And that gives support to pollinators. And for those who want to follow that vein into a little bit more geeky, I bring easy to read, a little geeky, but the farm is an ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And these two books every farmer should read.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you don't believe it, read it. The Farm as an Ecosystem is written by Jerry Brunetti.
Mm-hmm.
It gets way more into detail and the ion exchange and the soils and mm-hmm. how all that builds and stuff. But if we can move agriculture that direction, just going to no-till will help pollinators.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're letting life still exist between the rows.
Mm-hmm.
You still harvest, you still make a crop, but in the end, you have potential to make more money because you're not buying all these inputs and stuff. And you're building a stronger ecosystem, which will help the pollinators.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's kind of agriculture related,
mm-hmm.
but if I might, you know, over the past couple of years, I've had a lot of people tell me, I want a beehive in my yard. I'm like, go for it. But I also say, what is your motivation?
Mm-hmm.
Are you wanting to have bees to create more pollinators?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want bees for honey? If it's for honey, go for it. You know, it's more work than you think. And you got to be willing mm-hmm. to take the knocks because you will lose hives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what kind of gets a lot of small home beekeepers kind of
discouraged
because they'll have a perfectly good hive, you know, the first summer. Or a lot of times the first summer, you don't even get any honey. Then over next spring, you open up your hives and everyone's dead.
Oh,
and
all your little pets.
All 40,000 of them are
gone.
Actually, this spring, there's not that many. But, and that's very discouraging. But if you want it for the honey, do it. If you want it for the pollinators, don't do it. Take that money and remake your yard into pollinator habitat. You will support. Don't mow things down. Leave flower stalks and sunflower stalks, leave them standing. Don't mow till your city's yelling at you. Right?
I was going to say, this is not going over well in a little town that wants you to have neat little yards and gardens. And
ooh, I understand.
Yeah.
You know,
have you
my neighbors
arrested?
Look askance at me. But when my prairie strips are in full bloom, they love them.
Mm-hmm.
But the upside is when their bloom's done, and I'm out there, I collect seeds and stuff, and then they stand there all winter until I'm sure the pollinators mm-hmm. are done with them.
Mm-hmm.
Then I break them down
well,
and I leave them there.
I never knew that. I never knew why to leave that stuff in your garden. And
even
not
if you're
just
a vegetable gardener.
Up,
leave your tomatoes up. Leave them hanging. Leave any stalks up.
Hmm.
If you have, grow cabbages, you know, you cut the head out and you leave the bottom brief, leave it. One, it builds back into your soil.
Sure, yeah.
But it's providing all kinds of habitats for all kinds of life.
Okay, that's great.
You don't need to till your garden in the fall. There is no need for it.
Okay. Just let it all just lay there.
If you're going to till it in the spring.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If you're going to do anything in the fall, plant a spring cover crop. Winter rye. Because that will feed your soil, its habitat.
It holds your soil down.
It holds the soil down. But that will help pollinators way more than having a honeybee hive.
Oh, okay. Well, we're almost at the end of our show, and we haven't even talked about when do you start getting honey, and then how do you get it out of the hive? We probably don't have much time to talk about that, but when do you start
it's
looking
mid-summer,
for your honey?
Midsummer. So you get a spring honey flow. It goes for a while, and then you start getting midsummer, and you may get a second one later in the summer. In a Langstroth-style hive like I use, which is your standard square, they have what they call frames that lift out, and that's what the bees build their comb on. And once the honey's capped, we collect them. We remove that cap from the comb.
Like with a knife or something?
With knives. Yeah. There's a whole bunch. And then there's real fancy industrial machines that use chains and spit them in and out automatically. But
is this when you smoke? When do people use smoke?
You smoke to calm the bees down when you're working the hive. What it does, my understanding, which has grown, I kind of for the first year or so, I lived under an old wives' tale. But my understanding is the way the smoke works is it collects on the honeybee's antenna, which are their sensory organs. And they can't communicate with each other to swarm you as much. They're more, less likely to be aggressive.
So and when you say working the hives, is that just taking out the honey and checking them?
You know, as a first-year beekeeper, I was out, I wanted to be out there almost every day looking at my bees, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I learned really quickly, don't do it. That's how many beginning beekeepers kill their queens because they're not careful enough, pulling the frames in and out all the time. Now I don't even look for my queen. I don't need to see her. I just need to see eggs. I start looking at brood frames till I see which are the bottom two boxes. They're bigger. I start looking at frames, and if I see eggs, I know she's been there, you know, within 24 hours. You know, mm-hmm. if it's standing straight up, it's like within 24 hours, then it'll kind of lay over. And that's so you can tell by the condition of the egg or the larva mm-hmm. how long it's been she's been there. And if she's been there within the last 24 hours, I just stop looking.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I may look in the fall more at the edges. See if they're putting up enough honey stores and stuff mm-hmm. like that, because that's where they put the honey, more towards the outside. Mm-hmm. Brood, eggs, they all are mostly laid in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we put a queen excluder between those brood boxes, those two big ones at the bottom, when we first put on honey boxes. And that lets the worker bees up through, but it's a screen that the queen, because she's just slightly larger, she doesn't go through.
No, I see.
And so once they get some honey going up in there, she won't want to go up there anyway. You can take them out after a while.
Mm-hmm.
Then we put them in we remove that cap, put those frames in an extractor, it spins them, and that pulls the honey out. We put it in buckets, tanks. There's all kinds of, depending on your scale. This year, I'm still in the bucket scale. Hoping by next year to be in a little bit bigger container mm-hmm. scale. We're on Facebook to kind of follow us and see my girls a little bit working the bees and the honey.
Oh, yes, give us
We're
your
on
country.
Facebook. So facebook.com/Tim's Tiny Farm. or just search Tim's Tiny Farm.
Aww.
And you'll find us there. We're also on Instagram under Tim's Tiny Farm. Not Tiny Tim's. That's a whole different company. Tim's Tiny Farm.
Yeah.
And you can follow us there. We still have a little bit of honey at the co-op and I believe at the public market here
so
in
So you
Brooklyn.
Really actually have enough to sell.
I sold out of my honey in December.
Well, we're just about out of time, and I will keep you guessing and keep you being more interested in bees. We've been talking to Tim Kniep. Thanks so much for being on the show, Tim.
You're more than welcome.
I love talking with you. You are such a good instructor, and make it really interesting. So you've been listening to Who's in the Kitchen at WDRT 91.9. Our show is always on Saturdays at noon, and it's a cooking show, except the last Saturday of the month is now Digging Deep, which is same format, but it's mostly focusing on farming, and I'm sure I'll have Tim back again. So thank you so much to my audience for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
Eat more honey.